You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, the latest on the levees along the Gulf Coast. Gustav has left the area, and while the storm did plenty of damage, the electricity is still out for about 800,000 people in Louisiana. New Orleans was spared the Katrina-level destruction of 3 years ago, and many of the citizens along the coast got lucky. Gustav predicted to be a Category 4 was a Category 2 by the time it hit New Orleans. And as we head into the peak of the hurricane season, we are seeing a long conga line of storms. You've got Ike and Hannah and Josephine on the horizon coming up in New Orleans. It dodged a hurricane bullet this time with the levees continuing to hold. But my next guest doesn't know if it will dodge the next one. Ivor Van Heerden is the director of Louisiana State University Hurricane Center in Baton Rouge. He's also the author of The Storm, What Went Wrong and Why During Hurricane Katrina, the inside story from one Louisiana scientist. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Well, thank you very much.
Do you have electricity?
No. We don't have anything where I live. I actually had to drive some distance to find a telephone that worked.
Well, it seems to be, from at least the news stories we see on the TV these days, that the levees did hold up. There was a little bit of overtopping, but they seem to be doing their job on this one.
Well, yes, they did, but I think in what we really need to take from this, that this is another big wake-up call, maybe the final wake-up call. Because for New Orleans, for the levees, that got tested and failed during Katrina, this was a non-event. This was a storm, a Cat 2, that missed New Orleans, that went on the other side of the river, so to speak. It went west of the river. And yet, as we saw on national TV, we had significant overtopping in the funnel area and especially the industrial canal. So, you know, I certainly am not celebrating. I think this is pointed out once again how weak this whole protection system is.
Mm-hmm. You did a survey of the levees post, Gustav. What did you find?
Well, we haven't completed because there's literally hundreds of miles, but what we found was, for the most part, the levees did well. There was overtopping. However, there are sections down on the west bank of New Orleans and the home area we haven't been able to look up, where they had to do some shoring during the storm, and right now they're doing some work on them. There's still a problem on the east bank at Braithwaite in a non-federal levee system close to a control structure that the Corps of Engineers is working on right now. But, you know, we were very lucky. There's some sections of the levees on the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, the levee system that failed so catastrophically due to wave erosion during Katrina. Large sections are missing grass cover, and we were very worried about those in case we developed a large wave field in Lake Bourne, the water body that faces this levee system.
So you're worried about false security here, the feeling that, it survived this one, we're pretty safe.
That's right. You know, scientists like myself have been telling the powers to be for years that at best New Orleans has Category 2 protection. Recently, NOAA came out and made the same statement, and I think this storm proved it. This was a Cat 2, you know, that was west, way west of New Orleans, and yet in Lake Pontchartrain, in the funnel, across the river, so to speak, we had overtopping. And I think this should really get people to realize that New Orleans is still extremely vulnerable. But not only New Orleans. If this had been a Cat 4, then that part of the city south of the river, the so-called West Bank, would have been totally inundated, as would the communities of Homer and Morgan City. And those two communities especially are very important to the Outer Continental Shelf oil and gas, mining and exploration, and that's where the vessels come in to be supplied, and there's some shipbuilding going on as well.
What is your advice, then, to protect the Gulf area?
You know, the Mississippi River built coastal Louisiana. It has the ability right now to very significantly restore wetlands. We've just got to let the river go. You know, we've been talking about diversions, and we have small little structures that some of them we only operate at 10% of their capacity. We've got to get the river free. We've got to give it the opportunity to rebuild. And to help it, our barrier islands have been totally decimated over the years. We could very easily rebuild them by mining sand from offshore, and in that way create an outer line of defense into which we, the Mississippi River, could build, you know, these wetlands in protected areas.
Can wetlands actually keep back the tidal forces or the storm surge of a number four hurricane?
Yes, definitely. We've just completed a very detailed project with scientists from Delft University, where we looked at both the impact of wetlands on waves and wetlands on surge. And in terms of waves, the wetlands can very dramatically reduce the wave energy, especially cypress swamp. But even a salt marsh can knock down the wave energy on a storm like Katrina by about 60% to 70%. If you look at the surge, what we're finding is the numbers initially put forward about dropping the surge 1 foot per 3 miles of wetland, in fact, are too low. It may the reduction may be more like 1 foot per mile. And when you get to the cypress swamp, it's even better because these swamps do two things. One is they add friction to the flow moving through them, but because they're so high, they separate the surge from the wind because of the tree canopy and thus reduce some of that energy pushing the water forward.
And how long, though, would it take to restore that kind of protection?
Well, I think on the barrier islands, you know, within about 3 years, if we could bring dredges from overseas, the right kind of dredges, we could totally rebuild the barrier islands. But on that front, we're fighting the 1960 Jones Act that requires dredges that operate in the United States basically have to be built here.
So wait. There's a law from 1960 that says we have to use dredges that were built and made in America to get the work done we need.
Yeah, the keel has to be laid in the United States.
Why is that?
I
can think of 100 reasons myself, but let's move on and say that what you're saying is that we're not going to bring those dredges over. You're saying we have to put a new law in effect that does away with the old one.
Well, a group of us from academia and also from industry, the oil and gas industry and major landowners in Louisiana, are working with the James Baker Foundation with the idea of trying to come up with some legislation that would allow us to go and restore the barrier islands using federal sands from offshore and also get a variance on this 1960 Jones Act. You know, in the past, I've done projects working with dredges in the marine diamond industry off the west coast of Africa. So I know you can move sand very rapidly in huge volumes, and you can do it in open ocean conditions. I mean, the Dutch and the British have shown us how they do it themselves. So it's a case of we just need somebody in government outside of Louisiana, preferably in the White House, to take the initiative and say, we're going to do it. And, you know, it's that easy. It could be done.
Get a little variance and get those big dredges.
The sand is there. And you know, since 1994, we've been working on this, and we have the Mineral Management Service has agreed to allow the state to go and mine these sands. We've done most of the environmental impact studies that need to be done. A number of us have worked with all the national environmental groups to get their okay to do mining, or if you will, offshore mining. Obviously, they want to see all the impact studies done properly. So we literally have all our ducks in a row, but we just lack.
But isn't this something the Army Corps of Engineers is sort of involved in?
Well, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers has been the lead agency on the coastal wetlands restoration program that's been going on in Louisiana. And we really, other than a lot of small projects, we haven't had much luck. And to my way of thinking, the Corps hasn't shown the leadership, and maybe it's time to come up with something different. Maybe something like the Tennessee Valley Authority. I'm not sure, but this past week I've been speaking to a number of congressional leaders and some former speakers of the House and so on, and I think there's going to be a big move very shortly to try and get some changes made so that we can move forward on these big coastal projects.
Is there any way to redirect the silt back down to where it should be going?
Well, you know, the Mississippi River, in essence, it's like a forest. It's a renewable resource in that it brings sediment every year. It floods. It brings tons and tons of sediment. Right now, it all falls off into 400 feet of water. So creating diversions by cutting holes in the levees is an obvious solution, but we could use things like siphons. We've successfully built a few siphons in Louisiana, but they take surface water. One could potentially have the siphon inlet down towards the bottom of the channel where you get slightly coarser load and slightly heavier suspended sediment concentrations and siphon it out. In addition, to try and mimic the natural flooding, we could have a siphon every mile. Imagine a 3-foot pipe every mile over the levees just flowing back into the drainage canals that then run off into the wetlands. And in this way, we start to introduce the nutrients, we start to introduce the sediments.
Sounds like a simple idea.
Well, you know, what we've done to our wetlands by putting them in the straitjackets of the navigation and flood control levees is we starved them to death. And then we came and chopped them up with in creation of oil and gas pipeline and other access canals. We just got to turn it around. We've got to remove that tourniquet from the arm, the Mississippi River, and allow the hand to recover. And with all its distributary systems, we very significantly improved the system.
And under whose jurisdiction? In other words, who would make that decision to do that?
Well, right now, all of that falls under the Corps of Engineers, and they are under instruction from Congress to come up with a large-scale restoration and levee plan. Some of what we've seen already and some of what we heard is that this is really a bunch of old projects where the covers dusted off, put into a big three-hole binder, and it lacks some of the new ideas, it lacks a new way of thinking. You know, we've got the Chafalaya River. We can change its discharge and so on. But Corps of Engineers officials are telling us that, you know, we can only take a very limited amount of water out of the river because they're worried about navigation.
Right.
But there's no studies.
Okay. Let me just remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Ivor Van Heerden of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center in Baton Rouge. So are you optimistic about getting something changed here?
I think so. Based on the phone calls I've been getting since a week before Gustav and now certainly afterwards, as folks start to realize that this has really shown us how weak our system is, my sense is there are enough congressional leaders and former congressional leaders who see this as a real need. It's a national need. From New Orleans, well, literally from Baton Rouge to the sea, that includes New Orleans, is the largest port in the world. 40% of oil and gas produced domestically comes through a pipe through Louisiana's wetlands. And then there's a lot of oil and gas that comes out of our coastal area as well. So folk tend to forget just how important these wetlands are beyond, the alligators and the fish
and so on. Well, good luck to you, and stay in touch. We'll keep checking in on you as this hurricane season rolls along.
Well, thank you, and thank you for this opportunity.
Hope you get your electricity back soon.
Thanks.
Ivor Van Heerden is director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center in Baton Rouge. He is also the author of The Storm, What Went Wrong and Why During Hurricane Katrina. the inside story from one Louisiana scientist. Time now for our pick of the week. Here with that pick is Flora Lichtman, our editor for digital media. Hi, Flora. You got a couple of videos for us, talking about videos on our website. If you want to see the latest videos, they're at sciencefriday.com and look at our video pick. What have we got this week, Flora?
It's another double feature this week.
Get out the popcorn.
Yeah, exactly.
This is where I came in.
All right. The first video was submitted to us by a researcher, and it chronicles how they tag these giant bluefin tuna.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty amazing. They reel them in like they're fishing for them, and they're scientists, and then they plop them up on the deck, and they do this super fast mini surgery and insert this tag. It's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, wow. And the second one?
And the second one involves a trip to the insectarium.
The insectarium.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
It's a building on Yale's campus, this little carriage house, and it's filled with tons of butterflies. And they're not just kind of regular old butterflies. Some of these butterflies have a special property to them. They have glow-in-the-dark eyeballs.
Their eyeballs glow in the dark.
You got it.
We're going to see that in the video?
You see that in the video. And basically the research is about how, it's not about eyeballs really, it's about eye spots on
the wings.
Those big
spots on the wings,
yeah.
And how they got there, why they evolved that way.
How they evolved.
But to do that, they have to see the eyeballs glow in the dark.
That's right. They have to make these mutant butterflies that have a jellyfish gene in them.
Wow. If you want to see mutant butterflies with eyeballs that glow in the dark.
I hope we're not overselling it.
That's weekend show. You know, with the storms coming up, that's some good viewing. A double feature from Flora Lichtman, our producer with digital media. Thank you, Flora.
Thank you, Ira.
As always. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director, and Flora is our producer for digital media. Josh Rogerson is our technical director and at the controls here in New York with a fine new hat on today. We also had help today in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you'd like to write us the classic way, you can address your envelopes to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036, or surf over to our website at Science Friday, sciencefriday.com. You see these great videos. You're going to like this one of glowing eyeballs. And also, we're podcasting and blogging there, and you can send us some of your own videos that Flora would love to look at. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.